Judy. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. The Communication Workers of America, Local 13,000, their unit 32, President Bill Castle is going to be here talking about the Verizon strike that happened yesterday. It's going to be going, I'm thinking this is going to go on for a little time. It'll be interesting to find out about this. Look, you know, when you look at these CEOs, I'm saying most of them are nothing but petty dictators who think that they have ultimate control, and how anyone dare to question their omnipotence. Well, someone's questioning it. And we'll talk to Bill Castle about that. Also, Barry Ernst, he has written a book, which, you know, again, you know, another one of these JFK books, another theory, another idea. Interesting conversation there. He's also going to have a signing tomorrow at the St. Thomas Roasters Coffee House on Lingolstown Road at 6 o'clock. So it'll be interesting to go out and talk to him. And in the second hour, David Holthouse, he's with Media Matters. He's their specialist on right-wing extremism. Back in 2002, he went undercover as a white power skinhead, even got access to one of the neo-Nazi leadership conferences. So it'll be kind of interesting to talk to him. And also, he worked as I think a lawyer for the Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama. So that'll be interesting. Because, you know, you tie this into what's going on with the Tea Party and what's going on with this whole move to the radical right. Where are we heading with this stuff? It'll be interesting to talk to him. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We got back from the Jobs with Justice Conference in D.C., and it really, I got to be honest, it solidifies my belief that Republicans are really strong-arming us down the wrong path. They have taken us in a direction that I think is going to destroy this nation, and I find it interesting. Because the big news today, of course, you know, the Dow dropped 1,600. They've downgraded us to a double A-plus rating. And I find it interesting that the very people who gave Lehman Brothers a triple A rating have downgraded the U.S. Now, understand, Lehman, you know, they were cooking the books. Did a little cooking there. So the information that was available, I guess you could say, you know, the folks who were doing the grading, thought the information that they were getting was credible. Silly, silly them. But it was bogus, and you know, it caused the nation to collapse. And I look at this downgrade, and I have to be honest, there's part of me that says, you know, the S&P people are right. They've got a point. Right there, we have no new revenue coming in. I mean, I think everybody agrees. Everybody I talk to agrees we can't do this by cutting and gutting. We can't do this with slash, burn, and punish. Not going to happen. No way. And if you actually read their report, the Standards and Poor report, They come right out and they say it right there on page 4. Can't miss it. They write, quote, "We have changed our assumption on this because the majority of Republicans in Congress continue to resist any measure that would raise revenues, a position we believe Congress reinforced by passing the act." So at the end of this, they're telling us flat out, you didn't raise revenue. You've done nothing to help you pay your bills. Now, look, I just checked my FICO score, which is kind of like my personal rating, which I got to be honest, I completely hate the whole FICO thing. And I'm not too fond of the S&P 500 and the rating system at all, because I don't buy into anything they have to say. I think it's all BS. It's all the industry paying for what they want. It's all, in my opinion, massive conflict of interest. But this is what we've got in front of us. You know, I just checked my FICO score before I came on here, and it's just north of 800. And, you know, I've never missed a payment. I've never been late on a bill. I use my credit responsibly. So I could make myself out to be the U.S. Rick and the U.S. are kind of similar, because the U.S. has never defaulted. They've never missed a payment. They've been on time. They've paid their bills. They've been reliable. Backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government, they have paid their bills without question, just as I have done in my personal life. Now, understand how the S&P sees this. Let's say I lose my job or I get cut back on hours and I have less revenue coming into my house. And I want to either refinance my house or buy another house, or even a bag of cheese doodles on credit for that matter. Would you be surprised that no one would give me a loan? Because I obviously have a revenue problem. And this is what the S&P people said. Not enough revenue coming in, folks. So we could be ticked off at them, which I got to be honest, I am. But reality check, folks. It's the rabidly anti-tax tea twizzlers and the conservative wealth class crusaders from both parties who have put us in this mess. That's it. Pure and simple. Doesn't get any easier than that. And you look at the reality of the countries that have gone through this. They've raised taxes to get out of it. They've raised revenues to get out of it. And I look at what Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's, what he told CNN. He said, quote, "I mean, without a good fiscal situation, we're not having a good economy. Have a business, create enough jobs, so that's a necessary condition. There's no magic bullet here," he says. "We've tried a lot of different things. It's going to take time, but there are things we can do, and I think policymakers will step up and do them if the job market doesn't kick in to a more significant degree in the next few months." So he's saying, look, the job people, you know, the people who are sitting on these trillions of dollars, they're holding back. These are the folks who are really holding the economy hostage by not hiring. And he's saying, well, policymakers may have to jump back in because we haven't. As much as, you know, the right wants to say, well, the Obama administration, they spent all this money. They spent all this money keeping people from collapsing. They spent all this money handing more with tax cuts. They spent all this money helping the states not collapse. They didn't do what I said they should have done from the beginning, which was, one, build things, rebuild stuff. You need manufacturing. When people have manufacturing jobs, they pay taxes. And you know what? It's a spiraling up of the economy. But we're not seeing that happen. And all we keep hearing are these T-twits. And I look in Wisconsin on Sunday. The Tea Party Express had their multi-hundred thousand dollar bus out there with the beautiful, I mean, you gotta love this bus that they've got. Just beautiful artwork, beautiful craftsmanship, amazing, expensive, but just amazing. So much for the grassroots part of this. But the woman's out there and she's giving her rah-rah speech and she's saying, you know, this week, and I wrote it down, she said, they're blaming the credit downgrade on the Tea Party movement. And the crowd erupted in cheers. And I'm going, am I living in some kind of weird alternative world where the people who are the ones out there pounding their chests, screaming, I'm patriotic, I love my country, are the very ones who are out there cheering its downfall? I mean, it's really very bizarre. Representative Paul Ryan also, you know, hey, it's a vindication of Republican action. We're vindicated. Really? This is what you wanted? This is what you saw? And his rationale is, well, a budget, you know, spending's too high. We brought the spending down. Yeah, but you collapsed the, you took us down and we could be double dipping. What are you going to say to all those people who lose their jobs now? And then Barney Frank came out and he said, well, it's military spending. And to a degree, I agree. We have spent a boatload of money in the sandbox, money that we could have spent here at home building things. We did hand out an awful lot of money to the wealth class. The Bush handouts, 60% of our problem. And you know, Howard Dean came out and said, look, you know, the reality is 60% of the deficit is due to the Bush tax cuts. 60%. And the reality is it comes down to the revenue. I also like what Howard Dean said. He said, I think, you know, the Tea Party's totally unreasonable. They're not founded in reality. And he also said that he thinks that they've been smoking some of the tea, not just drinking it. But when you look at this, it's more polarization. And this is what's kind of worrying me, that we're splitting apart at a rate that I don't think is going to be easy to reunite us. Because there's alternative worlds here. The reality is S&P said, look, you did not raise revenue. You can't pay your bills based on what you're bringing in. You can cut, 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 and you're never going to get down to where your revenue is. So you had to do both. You had to make cuts, and you had to raise revenue. But the right, there's no talk of it. The ideological extremists, there's no talk of raising revenue. And, you know, in Wisconsin, and again, tomorrow is a big day in Wisconsin, and if you got a couple of bucks, you can send it to the folks out there running campaigns. I'm sure they can use it. Make phone calls, do whatever you can do to help in these last hours. But, you know, they had a rally out there for one of the races, and this Judson Phillips, the CEO of the Tea Party Nation, another one of these sham groups, had a really bizarre statement. If you remember last week, he compared the protesters who opposed Walker to Nazi stormtroopers. Now, I was in Wisconsin. We were there when the people he's calling Nazi stormtroopers were opposing Governor Walker in Wisconsin. I was there, and they were grandmothers. They were handing out sweet potatoes. They were handing out pizza and bratwurst. I'm sorry, I'm not getting the Nazi reference, but you know, he needs to inflame, he needs to get people all worked up because that's what they do. There's no intellect there, it's all raw emotion. So on Saturday, he said, I detest and despise everything the left stands for. Everything they stand for. You know, like feeding children and helping mothers and you know, all the things that healthcare for people, all that stuff. He despises and detests it. He goes on to say how anybody can endorse and embrace an ideology that has killed a billion people in the last century is beyond me. And I'm going, a billion people? How do you come up with that? And it's that kind of bizarre rhetoric that I'm going, yeah, stay out there, buddy. Keep flapping your gums. I'm sure the woman who's running for to keep that seat, I'm sure she's really thrilled you're saying a bunch of dumb stuff like this. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this, the situation at CWA with Bill Castle, the Unit 32 president. And we're going to talk about today this whole downgrade. What are your thoughts? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Friday announcement that the unemployment rate dropped from 9.2% to 9.1% may not even be the glimmer of hope some were portraying it as being. According to the Economic Policy Institute, that decline was due mostly to a drop in labor force participation, not an increase in the share of workers with jobs. The Institute says that the labor force participation rate fell to 63.9% in July. While the population of working-age individuals grew by 7 million since the recession started, the labor force is smaller by more than 700,000 workers. EPI goes on to say that if the workers who want to work but have given up were counted in the unemployment rate, the percentage would be 10.7% and not 9.1%. The report finds that the average hours in a work week remain stagnant at 34.3 hours. If that number starts increasing, it would suggest to economists that employers are experiencing a demand for more employees. Stagnancy suggests there isn't any new work to be done. That said, those who are employed saw slight wage growth. The average hourly wage increased by 10 cents in July, while growing 2.3% since the same time last year. EPI also cites the underemployment numbers released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Those numbers seek to measure individuals who have stopped working and those who are working part-time when they'd rather be working full-time. According to the data, in July, 25.1 million workers were unemployed or underemployed. The Florida Farmworker Rights Group Coalition of Immokalee Workers has achieved historic labor agreements over the last decade. Many fast food companies have signed onto their campaign for fair food, which has raised wages and improved conditions for field laborers. Their latest target is an unlikely one, Trader Joe's, a smaller chain with a focus on organic food. Yet the management's unwillingness to negotiate triggered a wave of protests across the country. Alice Olstein reports from Washington, D.C.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has been trying to convince Trader Joe's to join the campaign for fair food for over a year. In May, Trader Joe's published a letter explaining their refusal. Trader Joe's quotes the company's own human rights criteria and says they don't need third-party verification. Mark Rodriguez with the Student Farmworker Alliance disagrees.
Don't they have to abide by some kind of certification or monitoring in order to sell organic products? And so if they could do that for organic, why can't they do essentially the same thing for human rights? And that's all we're asking, is that they agree to an independent third party, which is going to make sure that people's basic human rights are being respected in the fields where they get their tomatoes from.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Alice Olstein.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Show 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Thomas Reuters did an analysis of global data, and what he came up with is the gap in compensation between the CEOs of the world and the average worker at major U.S. corporations is running about twice as wide as that in the gap between the British corporation CEO and their workers, and four times wider than the CEO worker pay gap at major Swedish corporations. We're seeing the division of wealth. We're seeing the economic pie being sliced in such a way that the people who are actually busting their humps doing the work are not the ones being rewarded for it. And I blame that solely on the fact that what we have seen in this country is an all-out frontal assault on workers' rights to organize. And it's never been more apparent than it is this year, as we've seen attacks on collective bargaining across the country. And in the coming days, understand, we're going to be talking about it here in Pennsylvania as well, as Mad Cow's No Rights at Work agenda is up for discussion. And I guess August 16th, there's going to be a big hearing coming up. It'll be at from 1 to 4 here in Harrisburg as they talk about this no rights at work agenda. Now, how many people would have really thought it would have gotten to this point? Because these radicals, these extremists, they like things just the way they are. In fact, they want them worse. They want that pay even more skewed. They want that gap wider. They want that gulf deeper. so that those who create the wealth, the working people, they're the ones who are desperate. They're the ones who are struggling. And you look at this thing with Verizon and what they are trying to do. And we're, I guess Bill Castle's busy with negotiation. We'll get him back as soon as we can get a hold of him. But right now, you know, these are critical hours for these folks who are out on strike. And I've been on the picket line. I know how fluid moments are. There might be an opportunity to end this thing quickly. But the reality is you're looking at Verizon, a corporation that has an annual revenue, 2011 annualized revenue, $108 billion. Their net profit, $6 billion. That's what they're putting in their pockets. The wireless division just paid the parent company a $10 billion dividend. They've got money. This is not a company that's struggling. And you look at their top five executives, their CEOs, who over the past 4 years have taken over $258 million. Their CEO, one guy alone, over 4 years, $81 million. Here's a guy who's going to have guaranteed health care for life. And not only will he have guaranteed health care till the day he dies, so will his wife. And this guy and these people want to deny just a little bit of dignity to the people who do the work for them and create the wealth that this company enjoys. And, you know, at the end of this, you know, you look at situations like this, and no strike is a good situation. A strike is one of those things for workers that you've been backed into the corner. You've got nowhere else to go. And the reality in this situation is Verizon wants to undo 40 years of negotiations. They want to undo everything that the contract holds in there for workers. No more job security, no more disability when someone's injured on the job. What they want to be able to, and the big one is this whole subcontracting thing, being able to contract out, being able to turn their employees into independent contractors. I mean, it's really nuts. And their health care plan, I was looking at some of the numbers on their health care. They want to up their yearly contribution to almost $7,000 a year. I mean, it's really just plain nuts. And if you look at this, this is just one company that's doing this. There are companies across this country who don't have unions who are just doing this stuff. They're just imposing their will. These petty dictators who think that this is my kingdom, this is my domain, my servants will listen to me. And at some point, there's got to be a level of garbage, you know, the dreaded S word. There's got to be a level of fecal matter we won't eat. There's got to be. At some point, you can only be fed so much of it before you go, enough's enough. And, you know, while I was at this Jobs with Justice conference, you know, I met a number of people from around the world. And the really thing that really grabbed me was, think about how much courage it must take for a worker in a place like Colombia to stand up and fight for their right to collective bargaining, fight for their right to a decent wage, fight for their right for some respect. When the reality of the situation is that any minute you could be pulled off the bus and shot in the head, you could be thrown out of an airplane, or you could just be walking down the street and someone shoots you. In fact, just when they announced that we're going forward, two more workers were killed. I mean, that courage, I don't think we understand. I don't think we really grasp how hard it is. There's part of me that thinks it's because we've had to fight for so little that we've been given all of this. And, you know, I love the Tea Party people who love to drape themselves in the flag and declare their courage and patriotism. But in reality, what risks, what peril do they really put themselves at when they're taking a pro-corporate stand? I mean, what peril? I mean, in this country, workers are under attack every single day. While the modern robber barons, they've learned from their predecessors. They're not shooting people anymore. They're not bringing in the militia. They're not bringing in their private hired guns. They're not bringing in the Pinkertons to start shooting people. They've learned from that. That's bad for PR. It's bad for business. And they're no longer hiring the goons with the pipes and the billy clubs to beat up the workers. No. But their current tactic is no less deadly. I mean, starving someone to death is no worse, no better or no worse than shooting them or beating them to death with a club. But that's still what's going on. And what's frustrating is, you know, as I talk to these people from around the world, they don't understand why we put up with what we put up with here when we have what they're willing to die for. And we're willing to throw it away. I mean, that's the message I really took from folks, that they want to have at least what we have. And they're willing to stand up, fight, and die for it. And we seem to be dying to give it away. We seem to be thrilled with, yeah, screw those unions. Ah, they ask for too much. When the reality is, folks, have you looked at the greed, the avarice? Have you looked at what's going on in Wall Street and the boardrooms across this country? And before you turn and point your finger at the poor guy collecting unemployment, or the mother who has to use WIC, or the family that has to use food stamps to survive, why aren't we looking at the guy who's got 7 or 10 houses, who's moved all of his money offshore, who's paying 15% capital gains, because he made the right bet on Wall Street? Why are we not looking in that direction? Why is it that we seem to be hell-bent on looking behind us? You know, one of the quotes I got from someone while I was sitting listening to the speakers was, you know, we don't want just a seat at the table. We need a new table. Because the reality is that the current system is broken. The current system, this whole we can have a service-based economy, this whole we can wash each other's dogs and cut each other's hair and serve each other bad food. That's not an economy. This whole service sector thing, it's not happening. What's happened is we've lost our manufacturing base. We've lost our capacity to make things. And while service sector jobs were paying better and better and better, it was really the manufacturing jobs that propped it up. And the people who are most angry, the T-Twizzlers, are the ones who aren't getting it. Globalization screwed you. Free trade screwed you. The very policies that you're advocating are the very policies that screwed you. And now you're just angry, and it's visceral. You know, back when a guy was working on an assembly line making 20 bucks an hour, he was okay with his teacher, the teacher making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, because he was making a good living. He didn't mind paying taxes because he was making a good living. Now he's working that factory job making 8 bucks an hour. He can't afford to have a car to get back and forth to work. And, you know, he's looking at the public sector workers going, well, I'm miserable. You should be miserable too. And that was by design. All this stuff was put together for what reason? To divide us, to keep us at each other's throats. And another thing I took from this conference, and I've said this before, and I've always been on board with it. I don't have a problem with the Chinese workers or the Mexican workers or the Indian workers. I don't have a problem with them. They're in the same boat we are. I've got to feed my family. They've got to feed their family. They want to have decent schools and safe neighborhoods and health care, and they want to have the same things that we want. Workers across the world want the same stuff. But we've been pitted against each other by the same player all across the world. And that, to me, is what is really amazing. And until we can figure out how to bridge our differences, we're going to continue to lose, Jake. And at the end of this, if we don't figure out how to bridge our differences and heal those divides, we are going to continue to be sliced and diced and pitted against one another.
Well, our enemies, and although maybe I shouldn't frame it that way, but the Tea Party, I thought, and you did too, there was a glimmer of hope. We thought maybe they'd come into office and they'd agree with us, look at the exorbitant tax breaks we give to corporate America, look at the unconscionable tax breaks to the wealthy that have cost this country long-term, $2.5 trillion. We thought that there might be some issues that we can agree on. they've proven themselves to just be a lackey, for lack of a better word, of the corporate interests. Hopefully they've overplayed. Certainly there's a lot of Americans who are angry. There's a lot of Americans who have a 401k that has lost money in the last week. They have retirement that has lost money in the last week. And we can preach and preach and preach, but until it comes back and affects Americans directly, sometimes they don't listen. I think there's a lot of Americans now that are listening. Hopefully that'll represent a change in 2012. Now, it's a long way off, but I truly believe that many Americans already have grasped the simple truth that these people are here not to make government work, but to destroy government and make sure it doesn't work.
Well, they told you that. They hate government. There's no big surprise there.
Well, some of them couch it. Some of them couch it, but in the end, that's exactly what they don't want to do.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts on this? Right back.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Sheesh. In his big battle over the debt ceiling, Barack Obama waved his white hanky of surrender, allowing the loopiest of the Tea Party extremists in the Republican House to slash some $1 trillion from national programs that ordinary Americans count on. Obama's bad deal also puts Social Security and Medicare at risk, while promising to make our depressed economy and even the deficit worse. And he cravenly conceded to the demand by GOP Tea Party extremists that tax-dodging corporations, hedge fund profiteers, and the richest 1% of our nation's plutocratic elite keep every dime of their subsidies, tax breaks, and other federal giveaways. Not to worry, though, for Obama now says that stage 2 of the deficit reduction process will be better. The pampered and privileged few, he insists, will also have to chip in, and that he'll be fighting for fundamental principles of fairness. But we've all seen again and again that this guy fights by backing up and begging for compromise. He talks tough about fighting for fairness next time. When will next time be now? I know a bit about fighting, having been a small guy growing up in a small Texas town where confrontations often popped up. I learned early on that you should never hit a man with glasses. You should hit him with something much heavier. The heavy something that Obama has at his disposal is the fact that the American people are overwhelmingly on his side in this fight. This is Jim Hightower saying, rather than playing budgetary patty cake with Republicans in the back rooms of Washington, negotiating over how much of FDR's New Deal to throw out the window, Obama needs to FDR up, get out of Washington, and rally the majority to go after the greedheads and screwballs with a bold program that can get America moving again. Not only moving upward, but moving together.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender and it won't have it on. Just got time to say your prayer. Yeah, while you're waiting for the hammer,
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. During the break, got an email. I agree with you, the email says. S&P issuers-based pay model is pure conflict of interest. The companies it rates pays for the rating. how ridiculous. By the time S&P gets around to downgrading the credit, it's so obvious to everyone, knows it already. There is no value in their opinion. Unbiased and objective from S&P or any other credit agencies, forget it. These folks are captive co-conspirators with the Chamber of Commerce to promote the capital markets. S&P Chairman and CEO Terry McGraw III has a long history holding offices at the Chamber Economic Roundtable Board, a Chamber member in fine standing. He writes, "We need an independent nonprofit agency rating credits to get some sanity in the capital markets." And again, you know, I think most people think that these are independent organizations. They, you know, and we're led to believe that, you know, these are good upstanding groups because our government has given them the position. These three rating bureaus are, you know, supposedly the nonpartisan referees. They're supposed to be the one, you know, like John Roberts calling balls and strikes. Not so much. It's a pay-for-play scheme. And again, you and I are the ones who get suckered. Wall Street, trust me, the 600 went down, they're going to bounce back. They'll get their money back. They were playing with your money anyway. But they're going to be fine. It's you and me who are going to struggle through all this. Today, back in 1903... the labor wars began in Colorado. Today, the Cripple Creek mine strike began. And again, you know, what's interesting about the Cripple Creek strike, it's the first time that the militia was actually called out to support the workers. That hadn't happened up until that point, because evidently the company, the armed goons from the company were so strong that even the militia couldn't battle them back. And it took quite some time. There was an entire year of battling. But again, you know, here's where you start to see history repeating itself. The corporate powers have taken such a firm grasp of what we're doing as a nation that, you know, there are some who believe we can never go back. There are some who believe that we've destroyed the ability to control what goes on to the point where it's never going to go back. And what you then need is collapse. I really hope that isn't the case, man. I really don't. The Borowitz Report just came in just days after downgrading the credit rating of the United States to Standards and Poor's. Was on high alert this morning after an unmanned Predator drone was seen hovering over its headquarters in Lower Manhattan. While the mission of the Predator was unclear, some insiders speculate that S&P might be in for a downgrade of its own. The Predator appeared in the skies above the company's headquarters minutes after it was rumored that S&P was about to downgrade the U.S. into the same status as Pluto. As a so-called dwarf nation, the U.S. would no longer be accorded the same respect as a recognized country like France or Brazil. According to one S&P source, basically the United States would be considered a social network with parking. At the White House, President Obama offered no comment on the Predator's mission, saying only the Predator is an effective weapon against the enemies of the United States of America. He did offer apologies for what he called an accidental Predator missile strike over the weekend at a golf course in Virginia, which narrowly missed Representative Eric Cantor. And there you go. I mean, you know, it must be one of those Chinese missiles that didn't make it on target. And speaking of Cantor, did you see him this weekend? He, again, you know, it's one of these, he was on with Jim Cramer, on CNBC. And Cramer asked him, you know, about unemployment. And Cantor comes out and says, you know, the most important thing we could do for someone is get him a job. You know, he's dodging the question. He's great at that. But he goes down this line of saying, you know, we've been worried about pumping up the stimulus monies and pumping up unemployment benefits to a certain extent. You have states for which you can get unemployment for almost 2 years. And I think those people on unemployment benefits would rather have a job. And Cramer goes, look, I want to be very clear. And he says, very, very clear. On a day when we have good unemployment numbers, Cramer says, you know, that's terrific, but not a great one. And you confirmed not a great one. you are not in favor, and will you go against the president's wishes to extend those unemployment benefits? And Cantor, again, dodging the whole thing. He said, well, you know, I've said all along, Jim, is if we're going to spend money in Washington, we better start making choices, and we got to set priorities. If we're going to spend money, we got to cut elsewhere. Again, didn't answer the question. This is a guy who's going to allow those all those people who are on unemployment basically to be left off on their own. Understand, there aren't jobs out there. This whole frame that there are other jobs out there, they're not. And if you cut these people off, you will see less jobs. You will see the economy tank, which I got to be honest, in looking at this entire, this whole T-Twizzler debt thing, I got to believe, and I can only come to the conclusion, that is exactly what the Tea Party and the Republicans want. They want that Hoover-esque moment when everything collapses and they can blame Obama because they've been chafed on the behind since Hoover got blamed for it.
All that money that they don't want to give, the Republicans and the right-wingers and the Tea Party, they just blithingly ignore the fact that there is a multiplier. It is actually, to some degree, it's a stimulus. And you're going to, again, whether you're taking money out of the government by cutting back on programs or whether you're cutting back on unemployment, you're taking money out of the economy at a time when it actually needs that push, more money into it. They don't even talk about that. They just completely ignore economic realities.
But for them, man, you know, this whole idea that they can cut, and cause the economy to get worse and worse and worse, thus, you know, enriching the very folks at the top, that's good for them. And again, I go back to the question, who are these people representing? You know, I hear people tell me all the time, well, you know, I just want our representatives to represent the people. And I always go, well, which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the Rush Limbaughs of the world who today all he talked about was how poor people don't pay any taxes? And he was proud of the fact that he had at one point said, well, you know, we advocated for those poor people to pay more taxes because, you know, they don't have skin in the game. When the reality is they don't have any skin. There's no money, man. These are folks who are broke. And you're going, well, they should pay more. They don't have it. The average working family in this country doesn't have it. And why don't they have it? Well, they don't have it because the jobs that they have aren't paying. And I look at this thing with Verizon. And, you know, thank goodness that they're out there fighting this. Because if they just took it laying down, say, oh, yeah, well, I'm just happy to have a job. Oh, I'm just happy. You know, like any good Stockholm Syndrome victim, just happy to be a job. Oh, the benevolent corporation loved them. What's that mean for the rest of the industry? What does it mean for the rest of the working middle class? Well, it means, of course, you're going to be pushed down as well. And that's what they want. And trust me, these folks at Verizon, these are courageous people. In this country, in this economy, to say, you know what? I'm going to stand up for not only myself, but my coworkers and the rest of the people who do this type of work across the country. Courageous and should be applauded. And if you see them out on the picket line, give them the thumbs up, beep the horn, take them a cup of coffee, pat them on the back, and say thank you. Because they're fighting against corporate greed. They're fighting against these petty dictators who sit in these boardrooms. They're fighting against that. They're fighting for a fair share of the profits. And trust me, there are massive profits out there being had. You know, I go back to that J.P. Morgan Chase analyst. You know, the good flaming liberals that they are there at J.P. Morgan Chase, who said, look, companies haven't been profitable since the mid-60s. And why are they so profitable? Because they're stealing wages and benefits. I don't know how simpler it can be. I don't know how much more I need to boil that down for the simplistic in the T-Twizzler part of the country. I mean, is there a lower denominator than that? Can we go a more simplistic, I mean, can we make it any simpler? They are stealing from you. They are stealing from every working person because they have the ability to do it. The economy's in the tank. Granted, they've put it there, but it's in the tank, and now's opportunity. And look, a corporation, they don't miss opportunity. Look at the airline industry. Republicans held the country hostage with the FAA reauthorization bill. The government coffers not getting that $30 million a day in taxes. What they do? They raise their fares to absorb that. And, you know, Cantor said, well, or Ryan said, that's what they do, man. That's what they do. No, it was Cantor who said it. That's what they do. Because that's what corporations do. And you look at this and you go, at some point, do we not grasp reality? Do we not know when we're being beaten? And maybe we don't. Your thoughts after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Curious your thoughts, back after this.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference. The avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Come and check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the right has been really in spin mode. And you got to give them credit because they've got their messaging machine extremely powerful. I would say they are the mainstream media. The fact that, you know, gee, did you hear that S&P, the reason S&P downgraded us because we didn't raise revenue? Not so much. What they're trying to do now is they're trying to blame the entire collapse of the economy on Obama. And, you know, I heard it today, you know, and Obama inherited AAA rating. He inherited a 5.7 unemployment rate. Granted, the economy had dropped off the cliff and was heading down, 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 down. They don't bother telling you that because really their folks have already forgotten that. Their folks completely forgot, lived in their bizarro world. But, you know, they're saying, well, you know, he inherited this great economy and saying, you know, well, you know, we need to make those poor people take pay taxes. They need to have some skin in the game. Well, some interesting numbers came out last week that I went through talking about the tax situation. They were saying that U.S. incomes plummeted again in 2009, with the total income down 15.2% since 2007. So our revenues are dropping because people are making less money. The data shows an alarming drop, according to Reuters, in the number of taxpayers reporting any earnings at all. In fact, down by nearly 4.2 million people from 2007, meaning that one in every 33 households had work in 2007. They had none in 2009. In fact, average incomes in the country in 2009 fell by $3,500 or 6.1% in real terms with 2008, and they were down over $8,500 or 13.7% over 2007. So the working people of this country are being robbed blind. Why? We need more profits at the top. We got to feed those CEOs, man. We need more. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Stosh on line one. How are we doing tonight, Stosh?
All right. How you doing today, Rick?
I'm angry. I'm ticked off. I'm frustrated. I'm sick of these right-wing lunatics telling me that poor people who don't have jobs and don't have money, well, they don't have any skin in the game. Yeah. They don't have any skin, man.
I know. Well, like I said before, a couple of weeks ago, when they had that lady, it was a lady who was saying that these white Southern representatives can't stand the fact that you have a black man and a white woman running the country. And this guy from Colorado said he wants to drown the government.
Well, that's Grover Norquist. He's from Washington.
Oh, okay. Well, I got that mixed up. But this is exactly what they want to do. They want to use Obama as the scapegoat for everything, because everything they do is geared to make him look bad, and the only job they're concerned about is taking his. Everybody else, you know, they ain't worried about everybody else with a job. Their only job, their only plight is to get him out of office so they can really run the country into the ground. They're doing that now, thinking that white people got their head in the sand and they're not aware of what they're doing. But they got to wake up sooner or later, Rick. They got to wake up.
I'm hoping, man, and I'm hoping that we have the ability to get people, you know, fired up. And I mean, right now, I got to be honest, I'm now willing to defend Obama a whole lot more. He's done a bunch of things I'm not thrilled with, but you look at what these folks are doing, man, it's crazy. Just crazy, Stosh.
The thing about it, the people who turned out for Obama in 08, they left him out there high and dry in 2010. Well, and then I hear the brothers and sisters about Obama ain't doing nothing for me. I said, you vote in 08? They said, yeah, I voted in 08. I said, well, how about 10? No. I said, well, shut the hell up then. Excuse me, I mean to go.
No, I'm right there with you. I mean, you know, he didn't do what folks wanted. We didn't get the single payer. The economy wasn't really picking up, and you're right. They left him out to dry.
Right.
And we are now getting what we deserve for that. And I'm hoping, I got to be honest, I'm hoping that he can turn this around, because I don't see 2012 being much better.
It's going to get worse before it gets better. Yep. The thing about it, the majority of the people who will be able to vote, because they're ruling my people out with these change of voting laws, this, that, and the other. What I heard of the week that the Attorney General, Holder, is that him? Holder? Eric Holder?
Yep.
He said he was investigated and it's not going to happen. Well, it's happening. And I don't see, you know, them putting too much effort into making this change and stopping this right wing taking our votes away. So
that's why you got to be ever more vigilant, and folks have to, they've got to mobilize. We can't leave it up to a political party or one politician. And I think that's the mistake that happened after 2008. So many people thought, we've now got our guy. We've got a majority in Congress. We're going to get the things that we need done. And they didn't. I don't think the average voter took into account that the Democratic Party has this habit of when they convene a firing squad, they do it in a circle. And exactly what they did is they shot each other. And the Republicans helped them. Here, reload. Go ahead. Good luck. Let's know how it works out for you. I appreciate the call, Stosh. Thanks so much, brother.
All right. Thanks.
It's true. I mean, they had it, man. They had it all. And you had some idiot Democrats who did some dumb things. But I go back to this, and, I look at these income numbers. You had one in every 33 households who had work in 2007 had nothing in 2009. And you look at the number of people, the number of millionaires who paid zero taxes. Out of over 235,000 people making $1 million or more a year in 2009, you had almost 1,500 of them who paid nothing. Nothing. And that was up from just 950 2 years ago. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you look at the numbers, and it's just amazing. But our real problem is you look at how the economy has happened, how things have happened. 2007, we took in almost $9 trillion in income off of tax return. 2008 dropped down to 8.2. 2009, 7.6. So we're taking in less money. There's less revenue. For a bunch of reasons. The Bush handouts, the fact that people aren't working. You've got now 1 in 33 people who were working in 2007 not working today. Less money coming in. So is it any wonder that the standards and poor people said, hey, wait a second, you're not bringing in enough money to pay your bills, especially considering we're still in the middle of a massive economic downturn where we're still paying people who are unemployed. We're still overtaxing an already tattered social safety net. And what they want to do, what the right wants to do, is they want to... And I think Tavis Smiley said it, with this last thing, they declared war on the poor. Well, gee, Tavis, when did you figure that out? Congratulations, smart guy. You figured it out. Years late, but I got to get, like Al Gore, congratulations. You figured it out. You get the prize for today. It only took you almost 11 years to do, but you figured it out. Same thing with Tavis. Gee, there's a war on poor people. Gee, no kidding.
Well, this is one time I have to give the administration a little bit of credit. They went on TV and said this. Look, even though the S&P people have downgraded us, there's many people who, even after they downgraded us over the weekend, from other countries have brought their money to the United States because they know comparatively this is still a good place to put your money. Now, does that mean that we don't have severe problems? We do. And this country has to, especially Congress, has to address those issues. And somewhere along the line, there's going to have to be some income put in it. You just can't cut. You cannot. If I can say one other thing. Again, the Democrats, when the Republicans talk about not extending unemployment benefits, I don't hear them out there articulating what should be obvious to people. But a lot of people, they're living their lives and maybe their first reaction is, these people are lazy. But the truth is that they have had money taken off their check, paycheck after paycheck after paycheck. And if you don't extend those unemployment benefits, what are they going to do? They're going to go back to the states on welfare.
Yep. Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this with Barry Ernst, the author of The Girl on the Stairs. We're back after this.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
The
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Friday announcement that the unemployment rate dropped from 9.2% to 9.1% may not even be the glimmer of hope some were portraying it as being. According to the Economic Policy Institute, that decline was due mostly to a drop in labor force participation, not an increase in the share of workers with jobs. The Institute says that the labor force participation rate fell to 63.9% in July. While the population of working-age individuals grew by 7 million since the recession started, the labor force is smaller by more than 700,000 workers. EPI goes on to say that if the workers who want to work but have given up were counted in the unemployment rate, the percentage would be 10.7% and not 9.1%. The report finds that the average hours in a work week remain stagnant at 34.3 hours. If that number starts increasing, it would suggest to economists that employers are experiencing a demand for more employees. Stagnancy suggests there isn't any new work to be done. That said, those who are employed saw slight wage growth. The average hourly wage increased by 10 cents in July, while growing 2.3% since the same time last year. EPI also cites the underemployment numbers released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Those numbers seek to measure individuals who have stopped working and those who are working part-time when they'd rather be working full-time. According to the data, in July, 25.1 million workers were unemployed or underemployed. The Florida farm worker rights group Coalition of Immokalee Workers has achieved historic labor agreements over the last decade. Many fast food companies have signed onto their campaign for fair food, which has raised wages and improved conditions for field laborers. Their latest target is an unlikely one, Trader Joe's, a smaller chain with a focus on organic food. Yet the management's unwillingness to negotiate triggered a wave of protests across the country. Alice Olstein reports from Washington, D.C.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has been trying to convince Trader Joe's to join the campaign for fair food for over a year. In May, Trader Joe's published a letter explaining their refusal. Trader Joe's quotes the company's own human rights criteria and says they don't need third-party verification. Mark Rodriguez with the Student Farmworker Alliance disagrees.
Don't they have to abide by some kind of certification or monitoring in order to sell organic products? And so if they could do that for organic, why can't they do essentially the same thing for human rights? And that's all we're asking, is that they agree to an independent third party, which is going to make sure that people's basic human rights are being respected in the fields where they get their tomatoes from.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Alice Olstein.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Somebody's watching you, you like it. Somebody's watching you, you care. I don't know you,
how can I know? Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Our quote of the day from the book, The Girl on the Stairs, My Search for a Missing Witness to the Assassination of John Kennedy. It's written by our next guest, Barry Ernest. He's, quote, we are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts for a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood. And an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people. And, you know, you go through this whole debt thing and you kind of wonder. But again, the book is The Girl on the Stairs, written by Barry Ernest. Barry, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate the opportunity to appear on your show.
Tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, you're going to have a book signing and a little discussion at the St. Thomas Roasters Coffee House on Lingolstown Road here in the area. I encourage everyone to go take a look at that and maybe buy a copy of the book and say hello to Barry. Tomorrow at 6 o'clock, correct?
That's correct.
Let's talk a little bit about the book, The Girl on the Stairs. What made you write this? I guess, first, what made you write it? And second, there have been so many others who have written on this topic. What more can be added to the discussion?
Well, new evidence can be added to the discussion, and it seems to be coming out on a regular basis as more files are opened up in the National Archives. When I first got into this back in 1967, I was a firm believer in the Warren Report, and it was a classmate of mine in college who actually tipped me off to some additional books being written about the assassination. And when I read them, I was concerned about some of the discrepancies that I was finding between what the Warren Report reported and what the actual evidence seemed to indicate. And for some reason, I just got involved in it from that point on. This was 1967, and that eventually led to multiple trips to Dallas and countless hours in the National Archives examining the documents that actually had not been released publicly. And from that, it developed into a search for a witness that I became interested in very early on. I never intended to write a book. The research was done strictly out of my own curiosity, but I became interested in it enough that a lot of researchers began contacting me, asking me for help in their own efforts, and one of those was Harold Weisberg, who is probably the most noted expert on the subject matter in the world at this point.
Right.
And he actually convinced me to write a book about my journey to find this witness when I discovered the documentation in the archives that actually proved the woman to be correct.
Now, what is it, do you think, that still grabs people's fascination about this? Because I've seen so many books on the topic. There are so many different theories. I had one person tell me that he thought it was because this is really the first time that people really have concrete proof that their government lied to them. What's your take on it?
Well, I think that's part of it. There certainly are a lot of books written about the subject matter. A lot of it is garbage, quite frankly. A lot of it is disinformation. It is an enduring mystery. It has not been solved. The Warren Report is simply another theory in this case, and it's the government's version. Unfortunately, the evidence that the government used to support its conclusions is faulty in a lot of cases, and people don't realize that unless they go deep into this subject. It's clear to see, at least it was as I rummaged through the evidence over the years, that there was an agenda on the part of the Warren Commission to pin the blame on Lee Oswald. To the extent that a lot of evidence that was contrary to that was either ignored or discarded or mistakenly reported by the government in the Warren Report. And I think the fact that the case has not yet been solved and new evidence emerges, as in my book with the story of Victoria Adams, it continues to eat away at the credibility of the Warren Report and suggest that something new needs to be done, or at least reviewed in further detail.
Right, and Victoria Adams is an employee at the time of the Texas School Book Depository, correct?
Right. The background on her is that she was working for the Scott Forstmann Company on the fourth floor of the Texas School Book Depository on the day of the assassination. And she and others looked out the fourth floor window as the motorcade came by. And immediately after the shots, she and a co-worker ran out of her office and went down the stairs from the fourth floor to the first floor to get outside. It was an innocent move on her part. She simply wanted to find out what was going on, and as she told me, she couldn't do that by standing around with other women on the fourth floor. What she didn't realize and what she found out about a week later was that she was on those stairs at the exact same time that Lee Oswald was supposed to have been on them, as he came down from the sixth floor to the second floor. At the second floor, he, for some reason, got off the stairs and was confronted by a policeman and the building manager in the lunchroom there. The question was always, was she accurate? Was she telling the truth? If she had been on the stairs at that time, then she should have seen or at least heard Lee Oswald on the stairs.
Right.
The Warren Report admitted that. It said that if she were telling the truth, then she should have seen or heard Oswald. The fact that she didn't see or hear Oswald made her wrong.
So obviously she's the liar in this scenario then.
That's right. And so as a result, she was discredited very harshly, ignored by the Warren Commission. She told me that during her testimony, David Bellin, who was the commission attorney who was questioning her, flat out told her before a stenographer came into the room that he didn't believe a word she was saying. She pleaded with him to question the woman who came down the stairs with her, an obvious person to talk with. He refused. She pleaded with him to do the time tests showing when she left the window, how long it took her to get to the stairs, how long it took her to go down the stairs. This was the same person who, David Bellin, the same person who conducted time tests on every other single aspect, every witness who had some say in the matter of how Oswald escaped the sixth floor. Miss Adams was the only one excluded from that. This is the same commission attorney who in February of 1964 wrote to his boss that he understood the importance of what Miss Adams was saying, and he fully intended to resolve it. He resolved it by not doing a thing, basically by failing to interview the woman who went with her, by failing to interview anyone else to determine how quickly she went down the stairs, by failing to conduct the time tests involved in the aspect of when she was on the stairs. So she was dismissed, basically, and branded a liar, and that, of course, upset her because she knew what the truth was.
Right.
She went into hiding, and as a result, it took me 35 years to find this woman, finally on the West Coast. And when I did, she revealed the truth, her side of the story that no one had ever heard before. She led me to the two other women who confirmed what she did and when she did it. And it also led me to the documentation that proved beyond a doubt that she had been telling the truth all along. And that is a very critical, significant aspect of this case because, as I said before, if the Warren Commission wrote that if she were telling the truth, then she should have seen or heard Oswald, and she didn't, then that is a very, very crucial aspect of his escape coming down the stairs based on the timeline that the government put forward.
And thus the name of the book, The Girl on the Stairs, My Search for a Missing Witness to the Assassination of John F. Kennedy, written by Barry Ernest. You can see him tomorrow over on Lingletown Road at the St. Thomas Roasters Coffee House, 6 p.m. There's going to be a book signing and discussion afterwards. I encourage folks to go out there and talk about this and pick up the book, Another Idea. I guess the question I have is, will we ever know? I mean, are there documents that could prove or disprove one way or another? I look at something I just saw today, that Jackie Kennedy had recorded some tapes with Arthur Schlesinger. And the early claims, and these are just early claims, no documentation, but that was Jackie Kennedy believed that LBJ was the one who had JFK killed.
Well, that's one of the theories, and certainly there are a lot of books out on that. I've seen a lot of comments on that. I've seen it being misinterpreted to the point where she is claiming that LBJ was involved. That is not the case. The only thing I can say is let's wait to hear what the actual tapes say rather than someone's interpretation
Speculate.
Of those tapes.
Right. And, you know, at some point, you know, I'm hoping all of this stuff comes out. And I guess the other question becomes is how much has been destroyed? How much are we, you know, how much of the really important stuff are we never going to see?
Well, it's clear that there are a lot of documents that are still being withheld. There have been a lot of documents that are on record as having been destroyed or misplaced. A lot of the physical evidence that was used, particularly some of the bullet fragments, have mysteriously disappeared. There are rumors that the autopsy photographs, even the Zapruder film of the assassination, has been altered. It's very difficult to tell what is true and what isn't anymore. There is so much disinformation out there today. it's hard to imagine. There are claims that there are agents who even frequent chat rooms and discussion forums on the JFK subject trying to dissuade others and disinform others rather than have them discuss this case in some form of legitimacy. It's become a real mess. I remember when I started in 67, it was for a lot of people an honor to be looking into this thing, to be trying to figure out the truth to the assassination, and now it's become nothing more than a junk pile of name-calling and innuendo, and you don't know what to believe and what not anymore. There is so much disinformation and very, very clever, sophisticated disinformation in this subject matter.
Now, so let me ask you this, you know, if last question I've got, you know, if Oswald didn't do it, then who do you think did?
Well, that's speculation on my part. And one thing that I have done over the years, following the advice of Harold Weisberg, is to not speculate. And you're seeing
I respect
what happens.
That.
You're seeing what happens right now when speculation occurs with the Jackie Kennedy tapes. So I don't know who did it. I can believe that Oswald did it. I can believe that he didn't do it. But one thing is for certain, with the evidence of Victoria Adams, his escape from the sixth floor did not happen the way that the government has told us that it happened. Now, whether that means he wasn't there on the sixth floor, there is some strong evidence of that now. Whether it means that something completely different occurred as regarding his escape from the building, that is quite obvious now. But something is not right about what the government has told us that Oswald did between the time of 12:30 and 12:32 on that particular day.
Well, that's why I'm glad that sane people, not the crackpots, are out there investigating this stuff and doing it in a scholarly way. And I think The Girl on the Stairs is worth a read. I've been working my way through it. My search for a missing witness to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, tomorrow night, 6 p.m., St. Thomas Roasters Coffee House, 5951 Linglestown Road here in the area, beginning at 6. There'll be a book signing with Barry Ernest and also a discussion. Barry, great talking with you. Excellent piece of work you've done.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Sheesh. In his big battle over the debt ceiling, Barack Obama waved his white hanky of surrender, allowing the loopiest of the Tea Party extremists in the Republican House to slash some $1 trillion from national programs that ordinary Americans count on. Obama's bad deal also puts Social Security and Medicare at risk, while promising to make our depressed economy and even the deficit worse. And he cravenly conceded to the demand by GOP Tea Party extremists that tax-dodging corporations, hedge fund profiteers, and the richest 1% of our nation's plutocratic elite keep every dime of their subsidies, tax breaks, and other federal giveaways. Not to worry, though, for Obama now says that stage two of the deficit reduction process will be better. The pampered and privileged few, he insists, will also have to chip in, and that he'll be fighting for fundamental principles of fairness. But we've all seen again and again that this guy fights by backing up and begging for compromise. He talks tough about fighting for fairness next time. When will next time be now? I know a bit about fighting, having been a small guy growing up in a small Texas town where confrontations often popped up. I learned early on that you should never hit a man with glasses. You should hit him with something much heavier. The heavy something that Obama has at his disposal is the fact that the American people are overwhelmingly on his side in this fight.
This is Jim Hightower saying, rather than playing budgetary patty cake with Republicans in the back rooms of Washington, negotiating over how much of FDR's New Deal to throw out the window, Obama needs to FDR up, get out of Washington, and rally the majority to go after the greedheads and screwballs with a bold program that can get America moving again. Not only moving upward, but moving together.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Well, I gotta tell you, there aren't truer words spoken than that. The reality is you've got these huge multinationals who are no longer constrained by borders. They're no longer constrained by nations. General Electric is no more an American company than is Mitsubishi. The reality is you've got these corporate entities who are now immortal. And we in this country consider them people. And we had these discussions over the weekend. And I had a number of these with folks who, they're really, really working on trying to figure out where we go from here. What does the country look like in 5, 10, 20 years if we continue down the path that we've been on for the last 30 years? If we continue to pander to the corporate special interest, if we continue to cave to the wealth class and say, sure, go ahead, take all of this. We want you to have it all. If we continue to tear down government and strip we the people of the ability to really foster our own destiny, which is what's going on. They are neutering us right in front of our eyes and with no anesthetic. But you look at what's going on and you look at the fact that all of these corporations are now, they're hip-hopping wherever they can get the cheapest labor and the most exploitable environmental situation. And I'm looking at this analysis over at Reuters. The headline is Beyond Debt Woes, A Wider Crisis of Globalization. And this is in my, what I'm looking at, the first article that I have seen in something that one could consider a mainstream outlet. I would take Reuters as sort of a mainstream outlet. The very first article that I have seen that is somewhat critical of globalization. Now, personally, I've been critical of it all along, but our media, they've been singing the praises. Oh, we need to continue down the free trade path. Yes. The problem with free trade is we haven't done enough of it. We need more of these bad agreements. We need more openness. We need more open borders for goods and services and of course finances, but not people. No. Can't have that. We need to keep those people divided. We need to keep fostering those ethnic divides. We need to keep white people against black people and blue collar against white and union and non-union. And we need to keep all of those divisions in place because then we can control those people, the rabble, the unwashed masses. And then they won't come around and fight back. I mean, you look what happened in Egypt. Those were people who were hungry. Those were people who've looked and they saw their country, the haves having a whole bunch and them starving. And they said, you know what? We're going to stand up and fight back. And the problem is, and I'm going to read part of this article because I think it's right spot on. They write technology and deregulation allow both information and assets to be transferred around the world faster than ever before. Perhaps faster than states can possibly control, even with sophisticated laws, censorship, and other controls. It says the broad consensus at the 2009 London G20 meeting has already been replaced by a much uglier tone of polarization and mutual recrimination at both domestic and international levels, where once
we would have lobbied quietly. Russia and China are now angrily criticizing the United States, with Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin describing it as an economic parasite. The United States and Europe, far-right groups including Tea Party, Euroskeptics, and nationalist forces look to be rising, sometimes potentially blocking policymaking. On the left, calls for greater controls on unfettered markets and capital. What's going on is they've done such a masterful job of tearing down the borders to capital, the borders to services, that the people are screwed. And they don't really even, I don't think we've really got it yet. I don't think most people have figured out how troublesome this is going to be. We're not creating jobs in this country, because you still have that pesky minimum wage. We're not creating jobs in this country because you still have that pesky EPA. When we're willing to work for peanuts and we're willing to drink water that looks like sludge and drink air that you can cut with a knife, jobs will then return. When we begin to, when our economy looks like the Chinese, those jobs will come back. The idea that we have these corporate powers who are much more powerful than nations in many respects. When you have them uncontrollable and beholden to no one but the almighty profit, you got problems. And you look at the fact that the global currency valuations have become this other source of tensions. The fact that the Chinese have pegged their currency at 30 to 40% lower than the dollar. And there are some people who are saying that the dollar is probably overinflated by 30 or 40%. So you stop and you think about this stuff. You know, how many jobs are we going to lose before we wake up in all of this? And this whole thing of this whole global system. And this is why I brought up earlier, the guy said, you know, we don't want to just be seated at the table. We need a new table. You've got these individual companies, these super wealthy, these global citizens who have the ability to move manufacturing plants at the drop of a hat. They can go from place to place, and the article points it out. It says they can go from jurisdiction to jurisdiction to seek low wages, avoid tax, avoid regulations, and sometimes even detection. In many states, that helped fuel a growing wealth gap. And now you're seeing tensions. Look what's going on in London. 3 days of rioting. Now they're writing it off as, well, those are just a handful of hoodlums and criminals. No, those are poor people who are hungry and they're tired of being screwed. And you look at what this guy, this Charles Robertson said. He's the chief economist at Russian-British Bank Renaissance Capital. He says, without massive capital controls, states can no longer stop the destabilization of Europe, can no longer stop the destabilization of this globe. It has gotten so instantaneous that you have the ability to jump from place to place that the whole system's about to collapse. And I got to be honest with you, that's scary stuff. The U.S. is no longer the consumer of last resort. We're no longer the country where China can dump all its stuff. Yeah, China holds all of our debt. You know why? Because we don't have anything for them to buy. You know, when you're the global currency, you send out all your money. Because we're buying stuff. We're buying all that Chinese stuff. And all that money's going overseas. It has to come back somehow. So what do they do with it? They buy our T-bills. Because we're not selling them anything. Which is why, you know, there's a part of me that says maybe Keynes was right. Maybe we should have set up an international currency that floated against everyone. And maybe we should have set up a central trading bank that would punish countries for having trade surpluses and fine them. And then take those fines and pay the countries that were losing to help increase demand in their country. Because at the end of all of this, like it or not, we live in a consumer-based country, and we are moving towards a consumer-based globe. And the only way out of this situation is if everyone does better and everyone consumes more. Now, and there's a whole other line of discussion that goes along with the environment, whole long line of discussion about resources. But given the current path that we're on, the only way we dig out of this is more people consuming, more people buying products, more people using products. And I got to be honest, I'm not thrilled with that setup, Jake. But in the end of all of this, when you look at what's going on, and the article points this out, the fact that we've had low interest rates in this country and you've had these tax rates since 9/11, what's happened is the spending part has been unsustainable. What's happened is the U.S. government was spending money on wars. They were spending money on handing out money to the very wealthy. They were handing out, money for, unemployment benefits because the economy collapsed. And who did well? Well, China. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts. We're right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad.
Because the union's missing. Oh, boy, if that isn't the truth. You know, and we were talking about Walmart this weekend. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, if you want to chime in. We were talking about Walmart this weekend because they had an action when we were in D.C. where the Jobs with Justice people went out and did a little protesting in front of their headquarters in D.C. And, you know, the more you talk about it, the more you realize that, you know, these big box retailers and these big companies who are pushing for the lowest possible price, pushing these companies to China, saying, oh, when are you going to China? So we can pocket more money. They're the root of this problem as well. They've got the big lobby money. They've got the big, the big bucks for campaign dollars. They're the ones who've really pushed this. And, you know, at the end of it, there's part of me that goes, well, what happens when workers no longer have a dime in their pocket? You know, understand that this country was, and to a large extent still is, the engine that makes this globe go. This is where the consumption happens. We're like 4% of the global population. Yeah, we consume a quarter of the resources. So China obviously has a place to dump their stuff. But in this greed, in this radical self-interest, in this hyper-individualism state that we find ourselves, where all I want is the best deal for me because I'm a consumer, are we surprised that they're able to steal our jobs out from under us and cut wages from those people over there? It's okay, it doesn't happen to me. Are we surprised? So I guess my question for them becomes, you know, these big box retailers, what happens when nobody has any more money? Because most people I know, to be honest, are living paycheck to paycheck. They're struggling to make ends meet. They're struggling to pay the bills. They're struggling to keep clothes on the kids' back and food on the table, roof over their head. They're having a rough time. What happens when there's no more money? There's no more credit card to go to the local big box retailer? And they're all just as bad. There's none that are better than the other. What happens? Because the wages at those service jobs, the cashier jobs, that's not how you build an economy. And I go back to what I said earlier. You know, when I grew up in Cleveland, there were manufacturing jobs that were the key to the middle class. Well, I grew up in the projects, and there were people who got out. You know, you got out one of two ways. The kid was a good athlete, got a college scholarship, and got out of the projects. And then there were the people who got the union jobs at the Ford plant or at the Chevy plant or at one of those machine shops nearby or one of the places that fed into the auto industry. Because it made a good buck and you could get out. Those jobs are gone. All of them. Because we gave our manufacturing base away. It wasn't like we lost it. You know, the right likes to, you know, this ideological right likes to point out that, well, you know, it's competition. It's the unions who forced them to close. No. What forced all those companies out of business, what forced tens of thousands of businesses, manufacturing businesses to close were bad policies. The Mexican deal, the NAFTA, horrible policy, just horrible. And we're going to do the same thing with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama. It's coming, so get ready for that. But all of those trade agreements, and I'm not against trade. You know, one person said, well, you're an isolationist. No, I'm not an isolationist. I'm a protectionist. I lock my door when I leave the house, don't have a moat around it, but I do lock the door. And you know what? I've even been known to give people a key to come in when I'm not home. Occasionally. Not often, but occasionally. So when you talk about trade, there are countries that we do a pretty good trade business with. They buy from us, we buy from them. It's fairly even. We're both doing better because we're trading. And this is the thing I think most people forget. Trade for trade's sake is not the answer. Mutually beneficial trade, that's the answer. We have a good trading relationship with the UK. We buy stuff from them, they buy stuff from us. We're about even, so we're both doing better. We have a horrible situation with China. It's a one-way street. We're buying from them, and they're buying us. Same thing with Mexico, and I talked about this last week. Ever since NAFTA, we've had nothing but trade deficits with Mexico. It's a one-way street. We're not selling to them because, to be honest, they don't have money. Now, with Canada, we've got a nice relationship. Works. With countries that are similar, you do that. With countries that are not, you still trade with them, but you protect yourself. That's common sense. And I look at this, you know, this piece in the Los Angeles Times. They're talking about, the headline is, as U.S. stumbles, companies invest in consumer growth overseas. And the article goes into talking about how the American consumer is broke. We've got nothing but big debt. Wages are stagnant. In fact, they're declining. We've lost manufacturing jobs. You know, it's all going downhill, and these companies see this. So they're looking to the BRIC countries. You know, they're looking to Brazil. They're looking to Russia. They're looking to China. They're looking to India. That's where the growth is going to be because they're moving all of their money over there. And that's where a middle class is coming. You look at the Chinese. The Chinese are trying to encourage domestic consumption, which I'm in favor of. I guess my question then becomes, once they have local consumption, do you think they're going to buy American products? And the answer is, heck no. Their government's not going to allow it. We're the only ones dumb enough to give away our wealth for nebulous foreign policy aims. We're the only ones dumb enough to buy into this, oh, here's free trade, take the jobs. And you look at these big corporations, and the LA Times article points it out. These big companies are planning major layoffs. In fact, you know, it's hitting a 16-month high. We're going to see, you know, over 67,000 jobs shed in the coming months. And oddly enough, those jobs are going overseas. As we cut back, now, they use the example of Merck, who is, they're going to fire 13,000 people by 2015. You know, they're looking at it and they're saying, look, as the government cuts back on Medicare, as the government cuts back on health spending, as the government cuts back, we're leaving because there's no, nothing here left for us. And this is the consequence that, you know, we've been talking about, but the folks on the right are saying, well, we need to cut government spending. Well, that government spending is jobs. And one of the analysts for Kraft Foods, you know, put it quite succinctly. He said, our middle class is constrained. And they're constrained by big corporations who are fighting the ability of workers to demand a bit of those profits. And, you know, in the article they're talking about, well, we need a tax holiday. We need to bring some of those repatriated profits back into the country. And the Wells Fargo economist, the senior economist there, says, well, that's kind of dumb. Why would they want to bring it back into the country? Why do they want to repatriate that money? Now, stop and think about this, because this is really, really the crux of my argument with this whole repatriation thing. And this guy does a pretty good job of it. We've learned from the past, anytime we have these tax holidays, anytime we say, okay, bring those profits back in, and oh, yeah, please, invest them here, what happens is they just divvy up amongst themselves. There are no jobs created. There's no investment. What there is the wealth class going, oh, boy, a big pot of money. Let's get our hands in it. Well, that's what this guy's saying. He's going, look, if your business is growing overseas, why do you need to repatriate that money to the U.S.? You want to invest money where it's growing. It's not growing in the U.S. So what's your ulterior motive? And the ulterior motive is they want to pocket the money. If now, you know, I'm not against repatriation. If you say, okay, you can repatriate that money, but you have to use it for creating jobs. And if you don't, we're going to tax you at a 99.9% rate. Just to make sure that you say what you're going to do. And the article goes into this guy who, you know, to be honest, he's like any 54-year-old guy who lost his job, got sick, lost his health care, sold his Mercedes-Benz sedan so that he could pay his health care. That's what's happening to our country. I mean, this guy was living the life, man. He was living the dream. Got himself a Mercedes-Benz. Lord, he bought himself a Mercedes-Benz. But for health care purposes, had to pay off the bills. You know, it's one of those things. And he wants to buy another car someday. He says he doesn't know when, because he's been out of work for so long. But the article does say there's a bright spot. There is a bright spot in our economy, folks. Consumer spending in the luxury market has been going up. So I guess we should be thankful to our wealth class, and maybe we should repatriate all of those profits from overseas that they're not going to invest here, so that, you know, maybe they'll buy a couple more luxury items, and that maybe might possibly create a job here. But at the end of this, for me, I say we tax it. I say we invest in manufacturing solar panels and wind turbines, because some scary numbers came out this weekend. we're buying Chinese wind turbines. The U.S. solar industry is dying because it can't compete with the Chinese because the Chinese government is subsidizing those companies. The one industry that could save this country, we're allowing to be stolen out from under us. And it's all because we have these zealots, this faction, these blind faith, ideological right-wing lulus who have bought into this bizarre notion that, well, we need to have open borders for profits and we need to have open borders for monies. But people, not so much. We want to make sure we stroke those nationalistic flames to keep people pitted against one each other. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
They're selling make-believe and we don't buy that here. 'Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down. While the boss man takes his bonus pay, jets on out of town. D.C.'s bailing out the bankers as a farmer's auction.
They're kicking people out of their homes. And I look at this, I got this press release from the folks at change.org. And really, you got to go to this change.org website, sign this petition, these folks in Bend, Oregon. The press release writes, despite public promises to the contrary, J.P. Morgan Chase will foreclose on the home of a U.S. soldier's father tomorrow, the same day he returns from Iraq. They're asking people to go and sign up on this petition to make Chase honor their word, cut through the red tape, and help this family. It's the Collette family. They learned on Friday that the bank had denied their request for a permanent loan modification and that the bank is going to foreclose on the home on the same day that their kid gets home from Iraq. Now, the guy, you know, bought this house, put down $125,000. This is not the right wing, which is why you don't hear this on the right. You haven't heard them talk about this at all. On the right wing, it's that minority family who really had a couple pennies to put down. They bought a very modest, very cheap house, and they got themselves into trouble. According to the right, those are the people who destroyed the economy. This guy had a small flooring and countertop business, was doing very well for himself, put $125,000 down on the house. Then the economic collapse happens. Then Bush happens. 2008, the economy goes down. September, October, November, millions of jobs lost. This guy's now got problems. So he's trying to make ends meet. They tell him, don't pay your mortgage. Stop. Stop paying the mortgage. Default. And we're going to put you on a trial modification. Then they denied him. The modification. And they demanded a whole boatload of money that the guy obviously didn't have. So now they're saying, well, here we go. We're taking your house. And you go, this is the way we treat people. And I've heard story after story like this. And it's frustrating. Now, I got an email today from Andy who, he said, in your 727 podcast, mortgage bankruptcy discussion. The industry term when a mortgage banker holding a mortgage, these days sometimes an investor is forced to change the terms and conditions of the mortgage, meaning either lowering monthly payments at the same maturity or stretching out the payments, extending the maturity at a lower rate of payment is a cram down. It used to be a bankruptcy judge could force a cram down on the banker or investor holding the mortgage, but now it's no longer the case. The banks changed that rule a while ago. President Obama and his democratically controlled House and Senate had the opportunity to bring back the cram down, but they didn't. As usual, the Democrats gave in to Wall Street and the financial community instead of doing good, the right thing for homeowners. And you look at this and you go, that's what I've been calling for the longest time. This guy obviously could pay something. His mortgage is probably one of those, values tanked. He can't sell it. He's not making the money he was. Here's an opportunity to see a little modification, stretch out the loan a little bit. I'm not talking about giving the guy the house for free. And this is where the right loves to go, oh, you're just talking about giving away free houses. Nobody said that. The banks did something wrong, and they're all suing each other over it, and they're all being fined for it. I mean, there's stories every day. There used to be a way a bankruptcy judge had the ability to say, well, you know what? You can pay a certain amount. We're going to lengthen the terms. We're going to lower the rates. We're going to work with the person to stay in their home. Because this foreclosure crisis is very real, and this is... If this thing that the teabaggers did doesn't send us into a double dip recession, I guarantee you this next wave of foreclosures may. And you see now in the news, Freddie and Fannie they're in trouble again because of this. Their rates are going up. They're in trouble again. Here again, more of these bankers, more of this financial wizardry, more of that wonderful service economy where we created wealth out of midair, just... poof, there it is, wealth, virtual wealth we've created out of our stack of cards. And I still remember the guy who told me, I don't understand wealth. Wealth is infinite. You can create wealth forever.
I remember
that. I would love to find that guy today.
Getting back to this guy came back from the war. maybe this is one of these times where he just needs to stay in his home, and he needs to force them to throw him out. Maybe he needs to take a stand, get the PR, embarrass these people, force them to show up with cops to physically remove you from your home. A man who put his life on the line for his country. Those are the kind of things we need to do. People are going to say, well, you're breaking the law. Well, sometimes you need to break the law to change things for the better. And maybe that's what they need to do. I mean, what do you do? Just say, hey, tough luck. You know, maybe we'll try to change the system at some point.
Well, Pat,
you know, down through history, right?
Down.
You and I both know people had the guts to challenge the law.
Well, our buddy Pat Toomey, it would have been a harder down. Wanted more foreclosures. Would have been happy. You know, that's how the free market works. That's their worldview. And I say, you know, that whole thing in September of 2008, the biggest wealth grab in the history of civilization. They stole from us. They knew we had our entire retirements tied up in their investments. And, you know, they almost got away with taking half of our Social Security as well. They had almost got, they had people convinced. Yeah. Let's move Social Security over to Wall Street. What if 2005, when the Shrub's running around the country with his filing cabinet, what if we actually did it? What if in 2005 we move Social Security to Wall Street? What does this nation look like today?
If you remember, Rick, Pennsylvania was the epicenter of the battle. And I remember Senator Santorum going around the state, and the AFL-CIO stood up. And at every stop, he had people. And what was beautiful to see, I don't know how much you were involved, but I was involved in that. What was beautiful to see, Santorum and his crew thought that they would play to the young people who they thought would say, yeah, that sounds great. Let's privatize it. I want my money in the market. And you know what? There was an awful lot of young people that stood up and say, no, thank you. This isn't right. We want to keep the system. It works. It has saved literally tens of millions of people from going back into poverty. And we're here to say what you want to do is wrong. And that was beautiful. And they lost. And Santorum not only lost that argument, but he lost his job the next year.
And rightly so. I mean, these are bad ideas. But we're again talking about them. The fact that they're once again feeling emboldened. And look, maybe it is our collective memories aren't that long. But they are now feeling emboldened to say, you know what? Oh, gee, we need to cut Social Security. And oh, gee, we need to cut Medicare. And we need to cut Medicaid. And, you know, that's how we're going to save it. Under the guise of, I mean, think about the stones it takes to look someone in the eye saying, well, I'm going to save it. You know, I know you've got a hangnail there on your finger. We can save the hangnail if we just chop off the finger. That would work. You could take the finger with you. Then the nail will be right there. I mean, does it make any sense? No, it doesn't make any sense. And neither does saying, well, you know, we're going to save Social Security by destroying it. We're going to save Medicare by giving you vouchers. Well, that isn't Medicare then. That's a subsidy for someone to go into the for-profit insurance market, who I think is the downfall of this nation. Everything else put aside. For me, health insurance. The health costs in this country are going to kill us. Understand that. For me, the only way out of this is a single-payer system. But the right has been so trained and so echo-chambered to and so preached to that we're not going to be able to do that until they're no longer insurable. Or until you're paying $50,000 a year for health insurance and only making $30,000 a year in wages. What's it going to take? What is it going to take? But our friends on the extreme right, the Tea Twizzlers and all, they're fired up, ready to go. They're willing to take on They're willing to take on the country and see it go down the tubes. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about that because, this extremism getting out of hand. We're going to talk with David Holthaus, specialist in right-wing extremism with Media Matters, back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Friday announcement that the unemployment rate dropped from 9.2% to 9.1% may not even be the glimmer of hope some were portraying it as being. According to the Economic Policy Institute, that decline was due mostly to a drop in labor force participation, not an increase in the share of workers with jobs. The Institute says that the labor force participation rate fell to 63.9% in July. While the population of working-age individuals grew by 7 million since the recession started, the labor force is smaller by more than 700,000 workers. EPI goes on to say that if the workers who want to work but have given up were counted in the unemployment rate, the percentage would be 10.7% and not 9.1%. The report finds that the average hours in a work week remain stagnant at 34.3 hours. If that number starts increasing, it would suggest to economists that employers are experiencing a demand for more employees. Stagnancy suggests there isn't any new work to be done. That said, those who are employed saw slight wage growth. The average hourly wage increased by 10 cents in July, while growing 2.3% since the same time last year. EPI also cites the underemployment numbers released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Those numbers seek to measure individuals who have stopped working and those who are working part-time when they'd rather be working full-time. According to the data, in July, 25.1 million workers were unemployed or underemployed. The Florida Farm Worker Rights Group, Coalition of Immokalee Workers, has achieved historic labor agreements over the last decade. Many fast food companies have signed onto their campaign for fair food, which has raised wages and improved conditions for field laborers. Their latest target is an unlikely one, Trader Joe's, a smaller chain with a focus on organic food. Yet the management's unwillingness to negotiate triggered a wave of protests across the country. Alice Olstein reports from Washington, D.C.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has been trying to convince Trader Joe's to join the campaign for fair food for over a year. In May, Trader Joe's published a letter explaining their refusal. Trader Joe's quotes the company's own human rights criteria and says they don't need third-party verification. Mark Rodriguez of the Student Farm Worker Alliance disagrees.
Don't they have to abide by some kind of certification or monitoring in order to sell organic products? And so if they could do that for organic, why can't they do essentially the same thing for human rights? And that's all we're asking, is that they agree to an independent third party, which is going to make sure that people's basic human rights are being respected in the fields where they get their tomatoes from.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Alice Olstein.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's have a tea party like the Grover's Zoo. We'll serve the finest tea and fancy cookies too. Let's go through the neighborhood inviting everyone. Let's have a tea party, won't it be fun?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, I was reading an article, prosecutors in Jackson, Mississippi. They said that on June 26th, these two kids, Daryl Dedman and John Rice, left the party in a white suburb. They went looking for trouble. They went to a predominantly black part of town where they found this 49-year-old auto worker, a black guy named James Anderson, and they decided they were going to do their little thing, screaming white power and beating the guy up and all kind of stuff. And when they were done beating him up, and they were done joking about beating him up, they decided to run him over with the F-250 pickup truck that they had. And they killed the man instantly. And they're joking about it. It's funny. No remorse, no Nothing, according to the district attorney in the area. In fact, they were laughing about it. And the question is it a hate crime when they're yelling racial epithets, when they're doing the things they did? You know, it kind of reminded me of the situation here in the area in the Shenandoah Valley and up in Schuylkill County where those two kids beat up the Hispanic man, killed him. And the judge gave him a maximum of 23 months. Kind of makes me think about that. And I look at what's going on with the Tea Party, and I look at all of this ramped up hatred and this extremism that's going on. It scares me. That's why I've asked David Holthaus to come talk to us. He specializes for Media Matters in reporting on right-wing extremism. In fact, in 2002, he was able to gain access to one of the white power skinhead neo-Nazi leadership conferences. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
You know, I look at these stories, and, you know, it's angering on a certain level, and it's completely foreign to me on another. But there are definitely folks out here who they would beat you and kill you just because of the skin of that you're wearing.
No, there's no doubt about that. I mean, let me quote you some song lyrics from a songwriter by the name of Travis Tucker, who performed at a Tea Party rally in San Juan Capistrano, California, on April 15th. Which is the same day that the tax day Tea Party rallies took place, hundreds of them all over the country. And this is what he's saying. He said, "I got a rebel flag and a pickup truck, 12-gauge shotgun I keep for luck, and I don't like what I see. Well, I got an idea and a little hope. Get a really tall tree and a short piece of rope. I'd say that'd do just fine." So that's the entertainment at a Tea Party rally.
But David, the Tea Party's not racist.
Well,
isn't that what they tell us?
That's what they tell us, and it's certainly it would not be fair to say that everyone who supports the Tea Party is a white supremacist, or that the Tea Party is by definition a white supremacist organization. But what is increasingly clear is that out and out white supremacist organizations are seeing a huge opportunity in the Tea Party. To join the Tea Party, support it, co-sponsor rallies, hold their own Tea Party rallies, sort of co-opt the brand for two reasons. One, so that they can affect the Tea Party agenda in their direction, and also because they realize that the Tea Party is very fertile recruiting ground for their white supremacist organizations.
Yeah, how much of this is the militia movement of the 80s and the 90s that I remember? How much of it is the same organizers, the same people who are involved in that?
You know, it is a lot of the same players coming back out of the woodwork, if you will. You know, the militia guys, they haven't had as much to do with the Tea Party as the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists, for whatever reason.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, you look at these and you see the signs and, you know, most of the people that I know who identify themselves as Tea Party people, and this is just my experience, they're folks who, you know, they have no problem, letting their view of minorities, out in public. They have no problem telling you what they think, because according to them, that's just PC garbage that they shouldn't be able to say what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, in that environment, even if you're not a raging racist, it's still accepted. And I would say on a certain level, actually encouraged.
Yeah, it's accepted. And then, of course, if you're holding those views and you're being a little bit quiet about them, hearing other people so openly voice them or legitimize them is going to affect how you think about some of these darker thoughts that you may have.
You know, I had a friend who, you know, I had a black friend I worked with for a number of years, and he grew up in the South, and he said, he was an older guy, he said, "I preferred it back when they would walk up to you and call you the N-word to your face instead of being nice to you and stabbing you in the back."
Right.
And I guess the question then becomes, are we moving back to where, you know, a situation where it's going to be, you know, a situation where my friend is going to see that person walking back up to him and calling him the N-word again?
Yeah, I don't see that happening anytime soon. And, you know, Alan West, Congressman Alan West, who is African American, is one of the great heroes of the Tea Party movement. So it's and one thing that a lot of people don't understand about the Tea Party is that there is no one Tea Party, right? There's a half dozen major national organizations, and then dozens, if not hundreds, of just local groups that have sprung up that have all sort of just started calling themselves part of the Tea Party.
Right.
So there's no central leadership to this. So you got some Tea Party groups and organizations that I would say are not racist, and in a very few cases are actively anti-racist, do a very good job of policing their own ranks and of making sure that none of this goes on at their rallies. However, the major players and the leaders in the movement are not doing that. And I think that the big reason that they're not doing that is because they don't want to have to explain to the public what it is about what they're doing that is so attractive to Ku Klux Klansmen and neo-Nazis and white nationalists who believe that the only people that should be allowed to live in America are white, straight Christians. They don't want to have to explain that.
Interesting point. You know, because I got to be honest, right when this whole Tea Party thing started, I was on the air saying that I could easily be one of them. I was angry. I was frustrated. All the promises that were made, you know, my 401k was going to be $1 million when I retired, and you work hard and you play by the rules, you were going to be able to eke out a middle-class existence, all that stuff not happening. So I can see the anger and I can see the frustration. It was when they took this rightward turn, this extremist, ideologically rightward turn that I started questioning, and that's when I really started going, this is the wrong direction.
Right, right. Yeah, and there's the main group that is sort of driving the white nationalist agenda within the Tea Party movement is American Third Position. They've sponsored their own Tea Party rallies. They've had at least 10 of them, and they've also co-sponsored rallies with other Tea Party groups. And they openly set up literature distribution booths at number of Tea Party rallies all over the country. They are very widespread.
How much do we see in Pennsylvania?
They do have a chapter in Pennsylvania, actually, and I believe Steve Smith. Yes, yeah, one of their larger chapters is in Pennsylvania, and it was their chairman Steve Smith said for the article that I wrote documenting this. He said the Tea Parties are fertile ground for our activists. Tea Party supporters and the A3P, meaning American Third Position, share much common ground with regard to our political agendas. So that was the chairman of the Pennsylvania chapter of this group.
And, you know, and looking at the group that you're talking about, this, again, has come out of this anti-immigrant rage that is rampant in that area. You look at their congressman, that Lou Barlotta, that was up in that region. He basically ran on one issue.
Right.
He was the mayor of Hazleton, and they passed this piece of legislation, to punish immigrants.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and you see, I've seen a lot of parallels between the Tea Party movement and the Minuteman movement. Who Lou Barletta was just a hero of the Minuteman border vigilante movement. In that, both the Tea Party and the Minutemen, there was no sort of centralized one group calling all the shots. There was just about a half dozen leaders, but then also supporters of theirs in elected officials, like Mayor Barletta, for right. example.
But where does the money in this all come from? You know, a lot of these groups, we see the billionaire class funding, you know, like the groups like Americans for Prosperity and a couple of the Tea Party, the Express and the Patriots. Those groups seem to have some big money donors. Does that filter down to these other groups that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, that was interesting in that some of the Tea Party movement was sort of co-opted also by the corporate wing of the Republican Party as almost as fast as it was co-opted by some elements of the white supremacist movement. And it's hard to keep straight which of these major national groups like 1776 Tea Party or Tea Party Nation, which of them are legitimately grassroots and which are receiving, you know, Koch brothers money. But one of the reasons that the white nationalist group, American Third Position, has been able to sort of buy access in the movement is that they have money and they can co-sponsor a rally or they can, you know, buy some signs or things like that for some of these smaller, less well-funded, locally based Tea Party groups whose contact with their national sort of home-based umbrella organization is somewhat tenuous. So the American Third Position is very smart about in how they're going about this and which groups they're targeting to essentially attempt to take over.
You know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and I was one of the very few white kids in the neighborhood. We used to play this neat game called Chase the White Kid and Beat Him Up. And it, I guess it was a fun game for everyone who wasn't me. But, you know, very quickly, at a very early age, I realized that it wasn't a black-white situation. It was a poverty thing. That, you know, we were all in the same position once we got out of our neighborhood. You know, we were, you know, we beat each other up, but we were still, you know, kind of, we played ball together and all that. But once you got out of the neighborhood, I wasn't looked upon any better than my black friends in the neighborhood. It was a poverty thing. So right. I guess my question to you is, when you talk to these people who are at this rally, what brings them, what do they identify with in these groups?
They identify with the sense of being a quote-unquote real American. You know, and I'm sure you know, and your listeners know that the economic interests of by far most of the Tea Party supporters are not being represented in D.C. by the people that they help put in office. In terms of, I think that some of the same motivators that draw people to the Tea Party movement are also drawing them to the white nationalist movement. Just this sense of rapid demographic change in this country has people scared. And that combined with the economic situation we're in, whenever the economy tanks in America, right-wing extremist and racist activity goes up at almost a corresponding level. So
it's kind of the same thing that I've always believed, because during tough economic times, people turn to conservatism. They turn into, you know, the hyper-nationalist rage. They turn into these folks who are going after, you know, the least able to defend themselves.
Sure. I mean, history has shown that, to be clear. Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true.
And hopefully if the economy ever turns around, do you see this going away? Do you think that rage then goes away, and does it just go back dormant?
It'll lessen, but I mean, we still have the immigration issue to deal with, and you know, I think if suddenly, magically, the American economy turned around in the next 2 months, I think that you would see, the focus of, organized racist groups shift back to Latino immigration, which is where it was for, the 4 or 5 years immediately preceding the economic crash.
Last question I've got for you. You know, the 2012 election's coming up there. You got Michelle Bachmann, Snow White, and the other seven dwarfs running around. Who seems to be the favorite? You know, who is the who's out in front there?
Well, I think that
with the people that we're talking about.
I'm sorry. With the people that we're talking about. No. Rick Perry is going to be a big favorite of theirs. Big time.
Yeah, he scares me to death.
Big time. I mean, they love Michelle Bachmann, but I think that they know that she's not electable. So I think that they're going to get behind Rick Perry.
See, Damien Thorne, there he is. Yeah. There are only a handful of people are going to get that reference, but that's still what I'm calling him.
Yeah.
David Holthouse, I appreciate the time.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, and keep up the great work.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Fellow working class heroes, I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Sheesh. In his big battle over the debt ceiling, Barack Obama waved his white hanky of surrender, allowing the loopiest of the Tea Party extremists in the Republican House to slash some $1 trillion from national programs that ordinary Americans count on. Obama's bad deal also puts Social Security and Medicare at risk, while promising to make our depressed economy and even the deficit worse. And he cravenly conceded to the demand by GOP Tea Party extremists that tax-dodging corporations, hedge fund profiteers, and the richest 1% of our nation's plutocratic elite keep every dime of their subsidies, tax breaks, and other federal giveaways. Not to worry, though, for Obama now says that stage two of the deficit reduction process will be better. The pampered and privileged few, he insists, will also have to chip in, and that he'll be fighting for fundamental principles of fairness. But we've all seen again and again that this guy fights by backing up and begging for compromise. He talks tough about fighting for fairness next time. When will next time be now? I know a bit about fighting, having been a small guy growing up in a small Texas town where confrontations often popped up. I learned early on that you should never hit a man with glasses. You should hit him with something much heavier. The heavy something that Obama has at his disposal is the fact that the American people are overwhelmingly on his side in this fight. This is Jim Hightower saying, rather than playing budgetary patty cake with Republicans in the back rooms of Washington, negotiating over how much of FDR's New Deal to throw out the window, Obama needs to FDR up, get out of Washington, and rally the majority to go after the greedheads and screwballs with a bold program that can get America moving again. Not only moving upward, but moving together. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Seems to be what we're doing. Seems to be what we're doing in the country. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, we were in D.C., and as we're driving around, all I kept seeing were signs, the speed limit sign, and then photo enforcement everywhere. And, you know, it's one of those things, again, that really infuriates me. That people aren't outraged by the fact that we are now putting cameras everywhere. And I guess on the highways there in D.C., everywhere you look, they've got these photo enforcements. And, you know, we don't need cops anymore. We don't need, you know, we don't need people. We can do everything with technology. We can put those people out of work. And I look at the story over the weekend in the Patriot. They're talking about Pennsylvania not going to be one of the states who, when they arrest you, they're not going to search your smartphone. They're not going to look at your emails or your text or your voicemail, which evidently they're doing around the country. In fact, the Oregon State Supreme Court, according to the article, is set to hear arguments in a case where, you know, cops did just that. You know, they searched his phone without a warrant. And they found some stuff. You know, the police are saying, look, it's legal because, you know, we had a warrant for the person. And I'm, you know, kind of going, I don't know. Is that a legal search and seizure? Does that violate our Fourth Amendment right? You know, do you have security in your persons and papers? And can you argue that now that we're in this virtual world where there's no more paper? That what you have on your smartphone, what you have on your laptop, is considered your papers? I mean, your thoughts? I mean, I'm of the mindset that all this technology, the laws and our rights have not kept up with.
Well, it's incremental, and it sounds like the police have just taken that privilege and allowed the system to determine whether it's legal or is that worrisome to me? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Incrementally, they keep chipping away, chipping away, chipping away. And yet, you know, you mentioned a couple things, Rick. Where are these people who speak out against government? Where's the Tea Party? Where are they? Now, there's something where they would have a legitimate interest.
There's something constructive.
You know, you and I believe that government has its proper role in society. It can be a positive, but we also realize that government power has to be restrained, because once you give up a right, your chances of getting that back are very, very slim. And we keep looking at problems, and government sometimes just says, well, we have this right. Well, you know, the people have to fight for those individual freedoms, because, again, once you lose them, your chances of getting them back are not very good. Where's the Tea Party? That's where you're absolutely correct, 100% correct, Rick. They had some legitimate complaints, you would have thought.
I was there early on.
And where are they?
I'm angry.
Where are they? All they're railing against is, well, you can't raise taxes. Well, you know, you're allowed to have your positions, but taxes, excuse me, is just one of a very many key issues which affect our lives as Americans every day.
And, you know, the thing is look, you know, it's any of this stuff. And you go back to the Patriot Act. And the reason I was against the Patriot Act from the beginning is there's a way of doing all of that stuff. All of those abilities of law enforcement to look at all of your records were there. What the Patriot Act did is they just streamlined it and then gave some you know, a whole lot of latitude. And we all said, yeah, well, yeah, okay, fine. We're willing to give that up so we can feel safe. And I was at the time, I was one of the very few people that said, no, I'm not comfortable with that. I'm not willing. Now is the time you fight to protect your rights. Not hand them over and say, oh, please keep me safe. Because I've said it a million times, and I'll say it a million times more until the day I die. I can keep you safe. Jake, I can keep you safe from everything. But who's going to keep you safe from me? And that's my problem with giving our government that much power.
Well, the FISA laws and in the Patriot Act, you know, there are safeguards built into it, but it's pretty much eliminated the safeguard of search warrants. You know, from what I understand, now, you know, if the government wants to search your house, all they have to do is come to court and present
identification. Okay, I'm okay with them going to court. What this does is gives them retroactive ability to go back after the fact and get a warrant.
All they have to do is mention national security, and that judge has to offer it. Now, where's the safeguard, Rick? The safeguard used to be that judge has latitude. He can say to those law enforcement, well, show me why I should allow you the search warrant. Now that's basically eliminated. It's just a formality that means very little.
But once we start down this path, as you've said, there's no going back. And look, they have the ability. You know, and there was a case that they pointed out in the article where a woman that was evidently putting on makeup and using a multimedia function on her iPhone when her car hit and killed a police officer. They were able to get those records, and they were able to do it the right way, and she was found guilty. She was convicted, and, you know, she's serving some time in jail. There's a right way, and there's a wrong way. And for all of our constitutional scholars, I would suggest we look at those and do what we have done constitutionally, which is you go get a warrant. You go to the court, and here's the information. Because, you know, all of this stuff, you know, every time I turn around, and the guy we talked to, Bruce Levine, last week, really hit a bunch of stuff on the head. And, you know, I got a whole bunch of emails over the weekend of people going, you know, he's right. The guy was absolutely right. We're training an obedient generation. And my wife and I talked about our kids. You know, are we training them to be compliant? I'm trying not to. But my daughter knows where all the cameras at school are. And is okay with it. And is used to being watched. And is used to being videotaped. Used to it. I tell the story when she was born. They offered to put a chip in her arm. She's ever kidnapped, you'll be able to find her. Well, one, I'm not that paranoid. Two, other than if she's kidnapped, who can find her otherwise? I mean, it's in her arm. you know, as afraid of the kidnapper as I may be, I'm more afraid of who has the code to search her wherever she's at.
And so this sounds like, you know, the book 1984, right out of it. Some of this stuff, you know, we should be very concerned about.
And I get a kick out of it. I mean, the one in Carlisle, the one vet group, they were actually anxious to have the camera pointed at their building. Again, you know, just you would think the people who would be against it with venom and with rage and with, this is my country, damn it, I want my privacy, are the ones who are going, oh yeah, please bring it in. We're happy. We're thrilled. Can't wait. Other than, you know, to keep, you know, those people away. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, back after this.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We
most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now for all the good news from Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So there's got to be some good news. The debt thing done. No more talking about debt, right?
Yeah. You bill me as the good news guy. Yeah, I don't know. What's the responsibility? The Dow plunged more than 600 points in a sell-off today. Plummeting.
Yeah.
Diving.
Have anything to do with the whole debt talk thing?
Yes. S&P, as you know, downgraded the U.S. from AAA to AA+ on Friday. And, of course, this was after the markets had a chance to react, so they got to think about it all weekend and sweat. And then Monday they came in and thought, okay, how can we make things worse?
It's kind of like the Dukes in Trading Places. Sell, sell!
Exactly.
Sell,
so
Mortimer!
That's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they did. And they made it worse.
I saw the pictures of people basically having heart attacks. I was waiting for someone to jump out of one of the office windows. Didn't happen, but I was waiting for it.
Well, I mean, because I think it wasn't quite that bad. Because the truth is that yes, this was bad, but it wasn't a shock. These traders have flat screens.
Yep.
A lot of them even have projectors. They have, you know, they have access to the news. They know that the U.S. has a debt problem. They also know that there is intransigence in Washington, D.C. So they know that both of the issues that S&P said were the reasons why it downgraded the country existed. So even though it was nasty and it wasn't pleasant for everybody to find out, it can't have been a complete shock to Wall Street that this happened.
It wasn't a shock to anyone. In fact, I think the S&P people were quite upfront about it. The reason that they downgrade is revenue problem. All we keep hearing from the T-Twizzlers is, oh, we got a spending problem. These folks are saying you've got a revenue problem. Congress, and this is page four, Congress continues to resist any measure that would raise revenues. That's the reason.
And will continue to resist that.
And will continue. And, you know, we're going to be where we are because we've got a faction in this country who is hell-bent on our destruction because they have this rabid, venomous hatred of taxation. I don't like paying taxes either, but I do understand we need roads, we need bridges, we need to pay for our misadventures in the Middle East, we need to pay for those big tax cuts, those big handouts we gave to the very wealthy. We need to pay for that somehow.
It's a real fundamental different way of looking at the world. And Eric Cantor today actually said to the Republicans to expect them to get increased pressure to raise taxes following the downgrade, and he told Republican lawmakers to resist that pressure.
Yeah, I mean, when you've got your ransom victim, you keep going down they're strong-arming us down the wrong path.
Fascinating.
When the president came out today, did he make things worse? I mean, I saw the speech, very uninspiring. The whole kindergarten, we're still a AAA country thing just didn't grab me.
But it was kind of like, we're still a AAA country. It was very dull.
Yeah,
what
happened to that?
He didn't seem to have his game.
He must not have brought his teleprompter, because generally he does much better.
He does. He really seems very, very flat. It was quite extraordinary. It was almost like, why do you let him go out if he's going to be like that? It was quite bizarre. And he came out, obviously, during the time the stock market was open as a way to try and arrest the slump. And my understanding is that the sell-off increased while he was talking.
Yeah, it dropped another 200 points because as I was watching it going, really, this whole, you know, kind of the, it wasn't even rah-rah. It was just, you know, they may say we're not good, but we're good. It's kind of bizarre. I'm hoping tomorrow is a better day for him.
Well, and it could be. You know, look, I mean, for the stock market, certainly Friday there was a rally after a bad week. So why would it be that Monday there was a sell-off after Friday there was a rally? Nothing's changed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't put a whole lot of emphasis in the ups and downs of day-to-day. But when you have a 600 sell-off day, that usually grabs somebody's attention. It grabs some headlines, and it gets people all whipped up into a frenzy. Any other good news coming? Anything? There's got to be something good going on in Washington.
Well, Al Gore says that climate skeptics are peddling bullshit.
Okay. The whole BS thing, sure.
Yes. He gave some comments at an Aspen Institute forum last week and really was very, very angry. And he says that they're emulating the disinformation tactics once used by the tobacco industry. He said, basically, they pay pseudoscientists to pretend to be scientists to put out the message, this climate thing, it's nonsense, man-made CO2 doesn't trap heat, it may be volcanoes, bullsh, it may be sunspots, bullsh, it's not getting warmer, bullsh. And he went on.
Yeah, I mean, good
his
for him.
Final line was, it's no longer acceptable in mixed company, meaning bipartisan company, to use the goddamn word climate.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, Al. Maybe if you had some of that, some of that anger, some of that stand-up, maybe some of that back in 2000, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in today. I mean, he came out last week, said, you know, government's broken and we need to do something about it. You know, maybe he should have thought of that 10.5 years ago.
You know, it's amazing how a lot of these guys, once they leave office, start showing fire that you wish they'd shown at the time.
Yeah, I mean, if he wasn't so boring and bland, maybe if he had a little fire in his belly then, he did win, but maybe he would have, you know, gotten more votes. And it wouldn't even been that close. Lastly, I guess the EPA doing some things. The thing that Michelle Bachmann wants to close the doors, lock them up tight, and shut off the lights.
Well, this is interesting because basically the EPA have developed a draft policy on openness and on scientific integrity. So they had to do this, and It was in response to a 2010 White House memo that directed it to develop standards focused on scientific integrity, public communications, federal advisory committees, and professional development of agency scientists. So they've done this. And the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, which is a coalition of government scientists, said today that it's pathetically weak. In fact, they say it won't prevent EPA's upper management from suppressing data and other technical information from the agency's scientists. They say it's the weakest scientific integrity rules of any agencies. They say in many ways it's a step backward. They say actually under the rules, only scientists can be punished for misconduct, as there are no firm rules against managers manipulating or masking technical work and no mechanism to enforce rules if they existed.
Well, that should sail right through bipartisan support right there.
It's fascinating because this is now open for public comment until September the 6th.
Yeah, I don't see any problem with that. I'm sure both parties will line up, support that. Sure, why not?
Fascinating.
Pathetically weak. That's the way to go. That's the way regulatory bodies should be in this country. Why do we need clean water or air? Why do we need to breathe? Victoria, you didn't bring me any good news.
No, I didn't.
There's always tomorrow.
Yes.
Victoria Jones, I appreciate your time. Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. And what do you got for us tonight, Jake? What's on the agenda?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Report coming out about Wall Street and their reaction. Their reaction to the Tea Party and what they have done. And there's some people in Wall Street that are, you know, getting a little bit nervous. In the U.S., the biggest problem is in Washington. It's becoming clear that the work for maybe 100 billionaires in the five industrial groups, and that's about it. Raposi goes on to quote linguist and leftist commentator Noam Chomsky. Raposi has written a book. He's written some commentary about this whole situation. This is what Noam Chomsky said, who, by the way, is a darling of the left, and I think he's right on. Corporate power is now concerned that the extremists they helped put in office may in fact bring down the edifice on which their own wealth and privilege relies, the powerful nanny state that caters to the interest. Very well said. I guess this goes to show you that sometimes you got to watch what you asked for. New taxes turn millionaires into fleeing tax refugees, according to some on the Republican side. Recently, the governor of New Jersey, Governor Christie, used that shaky rationale when he vetoed a small increase on taxes for millionaires. This was his quote, "Ladies and gentlemen, if you tax them, they will leave." But a new study about Christie and others are wrong. Tax fight is a myth from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities finds this. Compelling evidence shows that the claim is false. The effects of tax increases on immigration are at most small, so small that states that raise income taxes on the most influent households can be assured of a substantial net gain in revenue. The CBPP says that only about 30% of Americans, rich, poor, and in the middle, move from one point to another during their lives. The most common reasons are new jobs, cheaper housing, and a warmer climate, not taxes. Wisconsin. Tomorrow's a big day, Rick. We've been talking about this Wisconsin situation since we were out there back in the early part of the year. The labor people out there and the progressives have fought a valiant fight, and I think they're on the cusp of doing something real concrete. Tomorrow is the big election in Wisconsin, but in order to make sure that they're not successful, the right wing has poured in a lot of money. They've done some dirty tricks. We talked about their campaign to sign up people to use absentee and giving them the wrong date. We made that available. Also, there's some, apparently what they're doing, there's some right to life people handing out monetary gifts. Now listen to this. They're actually handing out money to their volunteers based on how many absentee ballots that they can obtain for the endorsed Republican candidates. There's also a right-wing third-party election bullying scheme training volunteers with incorrect information on how to challenge voters at the polling places. We wish our friends in Wisconsin the best of luck. According to Democratic spokesmen, and this is a real positive, they are very confident. They said as of late last week that three of the races the polls were showing very good numbers, and in three of the races it's a dead heat. They believe that they can win at least three seats, which would give them control of the Wisconsin Senate and put an end to the siege of the governor against working people out there. That's it, Rick.
All righty, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Fellow working class heroes, I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Well, you know, they had to find one. You know, there's real news out there. There's organization going on across the world. In Israel, in London, they're having riots. All around the globe, workers are rising up. People are organizing, coming together, fighting back against globalization and austerity. And what does our news report? Evidently, big story, a blonde woman missing in Aruba. Bring back any memories? You know, the whole war talk. Evidently, on August 2nd, Robin Gardner was last seen at the Renaissance Aruba Resort and Casino. She is now gone. The 35-year-old reportedly disappeared on a snorkeling trip. I hope the best for her. But again, this is not news. This is not something we should be spending an awful lot of time on. I want the best for her and her family. I hope they find her having Mai Tais on the beach. But it's the distraction. Another one of those. Because I'm reminded of that Natalie Holloway. Right in the middle of, you know, of arguing over war and having the debate, we're distracted. I can't let that happen. Cannot let these distraction happen. Another distraction, in Indianapolis, there was a woman who was doing a little tie-dye work, because she does tie-dye shirts, working on this special one, got the tie-dye going, rinsing this, doing that. She was at it, you know, she's been doing this about 3 years, so she's well-skilled. She was done with the rinse, she, you know, did a little color touch-up, and she was shocked by what she saw. There, on the tie-dye t-shirt, Jesus Christ himself. Right there. She said, I'm not a religious person, but I was shocked when I saw it. I saw the picture. I'm sorry, didn't see it. But, you know, it's all in the mind. It's all in the mind. Over the weekend, I don't know if you saw this, Jake. Evidently, under the banner of, it's not about me, it's all about Jesus. Rick Perry had his response. The response, held it at Reliance Stadium there in Houston, sponsored by the American Family Association, a whole bunch of really far out cuckoo radical. I won't even call them religious, and I'm not going to pervert the word religion with the American Family Association. But they had their big response. 20,000 people showed up, and I got to tell you, this guy scares me to death. I mean, he really does. I mean, it's scary. Scares me to death. Because at the end of this, yeah, for those of you who have seen The Omen, a little background music. I mean, this is a guy who actually thinks that he is the prophet, actually thinks that Catholics are the evil ones. And this whole response thing had a whole bunch of these really way out crazy right-wing preachers. And, you know, at the end of it, he's the guy who scares me the most, because he reminds me of Damien Thorne. Well, this could be the Antichrist.
Somebody should remind him he wasn't elected to be a missionary. I mean, this is America. You can believe what you want to. The last I checked, he was elected to be governor. And this man, I mean, he... And again, I got to be careful here, because I don't want to criticize him too much, but I believe when you stand up there and you open almost every meeting publicly, you step up to the mic and you start praying, at some point you pass that very, very thin line separating religion from the state. And I do believe that the Founding Fathers did want a clear demarcation, and we can argue all day, but how many politicians have we seen like this? Very few. I mean, this guy is just blatant about it. He's just flat out blatant about it, and does things in public that, you know, we find a little troubling and disconcerting.
Well, it's that dog whistle politic, and he's not even doing the dog whistle thing anymore. It's right out blatant, right in front of you. And, you know, this whole thing really, really spooky to me. You know, I worry that we're heading down really a dangerous course with this guy, because he truly believes he's the prophet. He is, you know, he's ideologically programmed to think he's the guy. And what he did with this whole the response thing is he surrounded himself with a bunch of really, really way out people. And, you know, I don't generally judge too much, you know, people who they hang out with. But when you're talking about hanging out with this guy, Mike Bickle, who called Oprah the front runner to the harlot movement, warned that traditional marriage will be defiled as the gay marriage agenda, which is rooted in the depths of hell, went out to say, this Dr. Cindy Jacobs, who said that, you know, the black birds are dying. They're dying in places like Arkansas because gay folk are soldiers. You know, they're a plague on society.
She actually said that?
Yeah. She called girl-on-girl kissing a plague on society. Personally, I'm kind of a fan of that.
No, I just saw some of that plague on society tonight.
Yeah, I'm not against it. You know, do what you got to do. You look at this John Benefow. He called the Statue of Liberty a demonic idol. It's a demonic idol.
Really?
Yeah, he said that. You know, homosexuality is a plot contrived by the Illuminati to limit the world population.
Ooh-wee.
These are the people Rick Perrier are hanging out with. John Hagee, who said that the Hurricane Katrina was divine retribution for the city's sin. See, because they had those people there, those gay people. And then that's God. He's making judgment. And most of this is this hatred of gay people. And that's only a handful of people. There's this other guy, this Dwight McKissick, denounced comparisons between civil rights movements and the gay rights movement because the latter is satanic anointment inspired by the Antichrist.
These people are given a new definition of crazy.
Coming from the pits of hell. Those are just a couple of them. You got the paramilitary guy, the director of a Christian paramilitary group, this Jay Swallow, which I kind of think is a funny name for a guy who hates gay people. I didn't make it up.
Don't go there.
He's the director of SWAT, Christian Military Training, organized for the purpose of dealing with the occult and territorial enemy strongholds in America. He's going to have, he's a Christian warrior. They're the ones who go out there and they're trained on how to pray for casinos. And you figure that out, because I can't.
Modern day crusade.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really weird. And you've even got some black preachers. This Willie Wooten, who said African Americans are cursed by homosexuals. He said the Democratic Party begets curses of adultery, incest, children from incestuous unions, born out of wedlock, destroyed virginity, bestiality, homosexuality, lesbianism, communism. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, sorry, hold on. The right-wing part of me was coming out. But that's this guy. I'm going, really? Are you that nuts? And the truth is yes. They've really perverted religion on a really scary level.
Well, to get back to the governor, I think it's pretty apparent that he's eventually going to run for president.
Oh, do you think?
All kidding aside, and I know, you did a good job. And those people need to be mocked. But you know what? What seriously is scary when you have a man running for president who believes that he has God's position on all the issues. I got a problem with that. I truly do.
That's because you're anti-God.
I'm not anti-God. I'm
yes,
just leery of people who use God.
You're anti-God.
To get elected. But he's serious, and he believes it. And that's even more troubling.
I mean, it's really bizarre. There's another guy, this James Garlow. He had his Faith in Freedom Conference. And he compared orphans of September 11th attacks, the orphans of the September 11th attacks, to children raised by same-sex couples. I mean, it's just really kind of this vitriolic ridiculousness, this, wow.
Some of these people actually sound a little bit like the crazy church from
Westboro Baptist Church.
Westboro, yes.
The difference? There is a difference here.
A slight, yes.
These people have money. These people are on TV constantly.
Well, Westboro has money when they get to sue certain people.
But if you pay attention to the upper channels, like on DirecTV, how many of these people find their way onto their channel? And there's you got to give the organizational part of it credit. They've gotten a lot of money, and they're able to run these channels, and they're able to do their preaching, and they can constantly put out that hate message. They can constantly put out that twisted rhetoric. To me, I think that's what's destroying the country. It's tearing us apart at our fiber. It's tearing us apart. And until we stop it, until we set it straight, we're on a wrong path. We'll see you tomorrow night. Have a good one.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.